Accession number 10165, reel number 16.
Martin McLean, reel 16. You were telling me about the circumstances of how you got married in 1938.
Well, she said, I'm not going back. And I asked her the reason why, and she told me about this girl who was pregnant, and that she had decided that she couldn't find the man who was concerned, and so she decided to give her ticket, her return ticket, which was a long return ticket, to this young girl, to see if I haven't travelled down there in the early hours of the morning to get to London, to stop people, to see if she could get the other half of their excursion ticket home, which was the custom. And in short, a man comes, buys his 10 bob ticket, comes down to London, he doesn't intend going back that day, so they used to sell them for half a crown to the people that were hanging around that wanted them, and that was her intention. But to get there, she had to travel from Woking, which is quite a drag with this baby, and so the wife says, right, or the girl says, right, you can have my ticket. So she hadn't told me about it, and when I went over and she told me this, I blew my head about it. I really went wild about it. I said, I promised your mother and father I'd return you the same way as I brought you down in a week. I said, this is between man and man, your father and me. She says, I don't care how it is. She says, I'm not going back. She says, it's lovely like this. So we went down to put the bands in the church down at Woking. And it was rather funny, this, she tells me about it later on, that a priest down there tried to talk her off marrying a soldier. And he's a Roman Catholic priest. I was very Roman, a very ardent Roman Catholic. And it shook me, this, that the priest had tried to talk her off marrying, I thought I was a good living man. But he said he'd give her a fare to go home. She says, no, she said, we might take it away. So that was that. Now, a soldier, before he got married them days, he had to make application in writing to the commanding officer for permission to marry. Well, I was 26, and that was the age when you could be married. If you are married younger than that, you are married as what they call not on the strength, which meant you weren't entitled to ration allowance, nor were you entitled to any married quarters. So I was now 26, I was on the strength. And so I was told that, yes, I could get married, but before this, the girlfriend had to produce three references by, like, a magistrate, by a priest, by people in position up Newcastle before ever she could get married. And she produced these. As a matter of fact, she still has them today, and she often waves them and says, Martin, I had to prove I had to marry you. And she still has them. And one of the few things that we had left of our home eventually. And so we decided to get married on November the 26th, which was actually 49 years ago this year. We've got a golden wedding next year. And so went down to Woking to get married. And during the Saturday morning we were there, I was a fanatic for walking them days and exercise. And from Woking Barracks, Napel Barracks used to call them, there was a canal just used to run further down from down the road from where we were. And it used to meander straight through to Woking. And I used to love walking along there among the different birds and the nice pathway and the fresh air. So getting married, normally a person would get a taxi or a bus down. But money was short, let's face it. So me and the best man walked down to Woking, which was only 4 miles away. He thought it was a huge distance, but not to me, 4 miles. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. We got to the church, and Anne's brother had came from London. He was working there. To give her away, and all the others arrived, went to the church and got ourselves married, and came out and I said, well, we'll go and have a meal somewhere. And now the wife, she says, no, Martin, we've got to go back to the barracks. This is all women's secrets, you see, you don't get to know these things. I says, what do we go back to barracks for? There's nothing there. The RSM's drill parade had been on then, was due on that time. She says, well, the married quarter woman had told me to bring you back to barracks first before we go anywhere. So when we went back to this married quarter where she was staying, there was all the friendly soldiers' wives that laid on a party for us, a reception breakfast, and it was absolutely great to see them all, their beaming faces and their congratulations to us. And we're sitting down getting something to eat when the RSM's drill parade must have finished, because there's knocking at the door. And in come my friends, my pals, with their belts on, and dressed in their knee creases and putties, straight off the RSM spray. They're just taking their bayonets off and their rifles, not allowed to carry them around. And they came knocking, oh, hey, Martin, we're going out. I said, no, I'm not going out. I don't drink. No. And then knocking on the door again, and come me platoon sergeant major Harry Quarto, and the bugle major, and Sergeant Etherington, all piling in, and others, senior ranks, come piling in, "Howie Martin, let's go and have a drink." That was the custom way of celebrating the wedding. So Annie, the wife, she says, "Well, Martin, we can't get away from it. There they are, they're all there, the room, the house is full of soldiers then. All my pals, the lads, they sat together." And of course, there's the soldiers' wives. The soldiers' wives' husbands had all shown up. And so off we all set, like a little army, moving down to a pub in Luanap Hill called the Queen's. I send a Christmas card there every year since I came back from the war, and I still do today to a man I met there. And I understand he's dead now, but we still send the Christmas card each year to the Queen's pub in Luanap Hill, walking. We all got in there, and it's not a matter of question of money. This is the sort of men that was in the army today. "Right, O'Martin, everybody chip in a half a dollar, 2 and 6 months. Everybody chip in 2 bob or 2 and 6 or whatever it was that they asked for." So everybody, every male member's got to put in that amount of money on the table. And then they order the drinks and until that money's gone. And if they want any more, they'll ask for more. But with 2 and 6, you could get about 5 pints of beer. Well, I didn't drink at this time. And I didn't know really what to drink. So I remember having a port and wine, port and lemon once at a New Year's party. So I said, "I'll have port and lemon." It was the daftest thing I ever said I'd have, because I didn't know how potent port is with its lemon. And I must have had about 6 of these things, and all the nice soft drink, nice and easy, great. But when I started going back to the barracks, walking up, I was drunk. When I got the married quarter, I was really drunk. And I was just useless to anybody. And so the lads helped me up home and up this married quarter. And the lad who lived in the married quarter, she says, "The best thing for you, Martin, is to get upstairs to bed and lie for a couple of hours." So that's what I done. And the pub shut at 3 o'clock, of course. And then come 5:30 and knocking at the door, and there's all the lads back again in civvies. They were going to make a David's. They weren't going anywhere. They were going to have a day of getting together with the lads. So this time, got me up, and I was drunk, and I didn't want to go out. And I didn't know whether I was on my head or my heels, because I hadn't been in this state before, bar maybe once as a kid when I had port and lemon. And I went down to another pub, I forget the name of it just at the moment. It was in Luanap Hill as well. And we all piled in there. And they asked me what I wanted to drink. I said, "Oh, I couldn't touch that port and lemon again. I'll have a beer." Well, the beer started coming in so fast, because night time the blokes were out for to have a nice night. From one corner of the table to the other, stretched pints of beer, which I had no intention of drinking. So there was I supping this pint of beers and enjoying them. And the lads again chipped in. Well, into this room came a couple of gypsies. Around this area, there's quite a lot of gypsies. And these people were in a national, national costume of theirs. Bonny colours, flared skirts, and were playing piano accordions. And they came in and started entertaining the troops. They were buskers, so just going around the pubs collecting money. So they had to chip around and paid them. And then somebody asked them to stay a bit longer, because they wanted to stop, because they were getting money and drinks. Playing away really heart's content. Everybody enjoyed themselves. And then came the police and arrested these two buskers. Took them away, that's the last we heard of them. And so, cutting a long story short, I remember so little towards the end of that night. I don't think I had me first night till 3 or 4 days later on, because every time I took a drink of anything, I was away drunk. Well, that's the type of men, the mucking and spirit you had in the army, who would all work together, and they wouldn't let... If one man was short of money, they wouldn't worry. But if they knew a man was scabbing, he had money and he wouldn't chip in, he got a thumping. But they had all to chip in the half crown. Chip in means put in. It was chipping into a kitty, as we call it. And everybody chipped in, so we had sufficient money for that night.
What were the married quarters like? What provision did they give you there?
Married quarters are very rough if you accepted the army standard of equipment stock that they give you. For instance, you received the chairs army sergeants, which was a wooden chair, nothing more nor less. You got no upholstery covered chairs. You got stool sergeants, chairs, wooden arm, and big metal steel things for your fire. For the fireplace, for the fire pokers, and the pans and stuff were all heavy iron metal things. The army blankets, for the bed, army linen sheets, mattresses. They give you a double mattress and single mattresses for your house. But it was all a very Spartan type of quarter. But everybody went then ahead to improve upon this standard, and they started buying buying things through hire purchase, or if you had the cash, you bought them, till we had a lovely home. And
how many rooms did you get?
We had two bedrooms, a large room downstairs and a sitting room, a kitchen. And all the cooking had to be done on a fire, but they got us a gas stove in, so we were all right.
Was it a house or detached? Or
no,
was it in a row, like a
terrace?
It
was in a row of houses. I'd say something like a pit curry row. All had their own bathroom in, toilets in, and all self-contained, electricity. And we made a lovely home of it. And we often think of it, the wife and I, of this lovely place, because it was our first home and we made such a nice job of it. Eventually, Annie, of course, various people had start reckoning up, or it's been a forced marriage, but it hadn't been. And Annie went home to have a baby, because the doctor at the hospital said, not at the hospital, at the MI room, who was an old Irish doctor, he says, "Now, my little child," he says, "I'd advise you to go home to have this child where you'd be looked after and cared for, because you're going to have a hard pregnancy." So Annie went back to her mother's, which was in Newcastle, Addison Road, and she did have a very, very hard pregnancy. And it was touch and go whether she lived, and the same with the oldest daughter now, Anne. So war was pretty imminent at this stage, and we were bustling around, getting stores, getting equipment.
How did you feel about the war? Did you understand the political situation,
yes,
you know, as regards Germany and the rest of it? Did you follow it in the newspapers, or how did you follow what was going
on?
Well,
the troops followed it with keen interest. They followed it to the extent, I think, they would have been disappointed if it had failed, because they're young soldiers and they wanted to show their skills. I make no bones in that. I'm quite certain, apart from a few, that the majority of lads were quite willing to go to war, and they didn't give it a second thought. That's what they joined for, that's what they were going to do, and they accepted it with, "We're just getting ready to go."
What did you think of, in 1938 it had looked like war, and then there'd been the Munich crisis. Had you been disappointed when that had blown over?
No, as a matter of fact, we weren't. We were quite convinced that Hitler intended to have war, irrespective of politicians or generals or anyone. The ordinary common garden man on the street knew that it was only a waiting time. It was only a period of time that Hitler had given Chamberlain maybe to prepare his forces a bit more. And we should have prepared more. We should have started making tanks, which we didn't have. And we knew we'd go to war, and we eventually did. So really, we are all well agog, well up in touch with all news, because as soon as the paper came in, it was picked up and read. And we used to listen to the wireless. We didn't have any television them days. Listen to the wirelesses and hear all the news that was going on. And different reporters who had been to Germany were explaining that they'd seen the tanks, they'd seen the troops highly trained, and if there wasn't going to be a war, then they weren't training these men up for nothing. And they're talking about the German Air Force. We all knew what was coming.
It's difficult with hindsight, I know, to separate things out, but from what you knew later, but what did you think of Hitler and of Nazi Germany itself? At the time, in 1938-1939, did you see them as bad as they later on?
No, I personally saw Hitler as a very courageous man who took his country away from being monopolised by other people. He'd made it a working job. He'd make it into something that really people had put their heart and souls into. We thought, if he'd kept up the standard that we had of the impression of him, instead of the dirty war that he created and all the things that he'd done, then I think Hitler, even today, would have been a much admired man, like Napoleon. But when it all came to pass that they had these concentration camps and his acts of cruelty by his troops and encouragement to do it, I'm afraid we turned our opinions over about him. We thought it'd be a clean-cut war when we went to fight with him. We had no qualms of this. But we knew fine well that we weren't equipped for war. All other generals and what have you were shouting, "You're fit, you're really up-to-date, modern, experienced army." We weren't. We had the equipment, we had the experience, but we had no ready tanks. We knew we didn't have any tanks. I used to go down to Farnborough. It was a big workshop where they used to repair our vehicles when they broke down. I used to like going to this place because I said I was an engineer before I joined the army, and I used to love walking around the workshops, watching all the different lathes and all the machinery work. And I had an option and a feeling I'd like to join the ROC, was them days, and become a mechanic in the field and things like this. But I never did apply because I was loyal to Durham. I said, I'm at Durham, and that's it. And I used to love walking around there. Well, at this camp, at this place, there are about 47 or more old tanks that was used in the First World War with a huge, great, big caterpillar tracks right around them. And they used to try them out every month, test the engines. And I used to make inquiries about this and check them. They weren't equipped with their guns. The guns had been put in, like, a mobilisation store out of the way somewhere. And they used to keep them in running order, ready in the event of war. And yet, believe it or not, during the Cold War, after keeping them all them years, they burned them for scrap. They could have been used ideal, the same things for pillboxes on the South Coast during the invasion scare. They burnt the whole red lot. Well, anyway, they were the only tanks we ever saw, apart from the ones I saw in Carrick, which I explained in an earlier version, the I tank, which I'd done some training with on Captain Moores. But we knew we had very few tanks, but we heard the talk about the German tanks. And we knew we had an anti-tank rifle which was supposed to pierce steel, and we knew fine well it wouldn't pierce steel, it was a bogey.
Had you been trained in that?
It was a 5.5 rifle. It used to fire a 5mm shot round, just like an enlarged rifle on a telescopic
tripod
in the front, bipod. And we used to take these on the moors and aim at tanks running past on cardboard, on wheels, and they were a very, very accurate weapon. And you could hit, I used to be able to hit a tank, and so did many others, the paper tanks. But when it come to push, and you know, I tried against steel, they wouldn't pierce steel. But what I found them useful for, not that we ever used them to any great extent, if we thought, this is going into action now, if we thought there was a German sniper or a German observation post up in a church tower, put a few of them rounds through, you just go through the stone and shift them. That's about the only good we had for them.
How did you know before the war that they wouldn't pierce steel?
Well, different people had tried them. You know, they'd got some a metal tank and stuck it on the range and had a bash at it. And it would go through rusted old stuff, but when you talk about armour, it just wouldn't touch it. And so the people just lost faith in it. And as a matter of fact, it was quickly dumped in France. But anyway, let's go back to before that.
Now, what preparations did you make for receiving the conscripts, national servicemen, that sort of thing? Did you have to build huts? I think you mentioned.
Yes. There was a big conference of officers in the battalion, and then they called all the WS sergeants and the NCOs together and said, this is what we're going to do. The battalion, the country is now going to call the men up as conscripts, they were, and are going to put them in the army, whether they like it or not. Each battalion will receive a number of brand new recruits. They'll be kitted out before they come here, and it's your job to make them soldiers. They took some selected WOs and sergeants from the battalion and made them into a conscript company, or two companies, so that they were responsible for all the drill, the training, the weapon training, and make them soldiers in general. Make them soldiers in a very quick time. And me being a specialist, now in the 3-inch mortars, I wasn't available for this. But we did train some of them later on, as with the 3-inch mortar, for reserves in case they went off to any other battalion that were 3-inch mortar trained.
What did you think of the idea of conscripts?
Didn't like it in the least. We thought these lads would never make good soldiers. Now, I'm speaking honestly, which I'd most likely get shot down with a loaded shotgun if the old soldiers heard me say this. But I've said the same in the local paper. I served eventually with these lads, and I thought the world of them. They were equally as good a soldier as any regular soldier. In fact, their fathers and forefathers who'd fought in wars before them would be very, very proud. They were great lads. They were enthusiastic soldiers. They'd do what you told them. They went into the attacks and counterattacks. Now, I'm only talking ad lib now, but I have been in them all. These lads went in without any qualms at all. A lot of them got killed. They just acted like true soldiers in every sense of the word, and I have the greatest admiration for the conscripts or, later on, the national servicemen.
But before the war, immediately before the war, you say you were worried by them. What was it that you thought they wouldn't be keen then before
yes.
the war?
I thought they'd be more have to be driven, you know, made to do this, made to do that, made to do the other. Instead of that, we found a pleasant surprise. These young lads, once they accepted the idea they were in the army, they fell into line and they became good people to train. They absorbed their knowledge of training from... This is, I'm told, from the instructions they were taking. These are good little lads. They're taking it in like a duck takes the water, they'd say. And they built huts outside the perimeter of the camp for these conscripts. And everybody just fell in line with them, or just one of us. Just
when did
us.
The conscripts start coming in?
Well, it was about 1938 sometime. I'd say about the end of 1938. I wouldn't be too sure. I've got an awful memory for names and people and things. But I was just living a life and I didn't make any mental note of dates and times. It was just a passing phase of the army. So going back on dates, I could be wrong on times and places I've mentioned before. But the facts are there just the same.
Right, now, at this time it gets into a little complicated because you got compassionate leave.
What happened is I was carrying on getting the platoon on training. We're doing a lot of training with the 3-inch mortars and the reserves and the national servicemen. We're doing a full day's work and training in the barracks, which is quite unusual of the pre-war days. But we're flat out from early morning to late at night, training, or marching, or exercise of a description across the moors. In other words, boosting up all efforts to be more warlike in the event of war, be more efficient in the event of war. And I was sent for but report the order room. You never know what's going to happen, postings and things like that when they send for you there. Sean McLean, your wife's sad to see your wife seriously ill. There's a pass. You've got 48 hours to get up to Newcastle, see your wife and get back. Now, imagine if you know where Woking is and you know where Newcastle is, there was quite some distance between them, and I had to travel to London, wait of a train which wasn't too regular then, up to Newcastle, and then see the wife in hospital, no matter what state she was, come back. Because I think at this time, war had been declared. Well, I think war was declared on the 3rd, and the baby was born on the 5th, yes. So... war was declared, and we're still the whole 2nd Division was on standby orders, waiting of orders for movement to see what was going to happen. And they let me off on a 48-hour leave, and I learned much later on in my service that I was the only person in the division allowed away from the source because the wife was in such a critical condition. Anyway, I went and saw her, and the matron at the hospital, or the sister there, I don't know which it was, was so compassionate, the thought that I'd been called from the army, you know, and everybody's now warlike minded, they gave me a bed in the hospital to stay there while I was there. And I stayed with her the whole 48 hours, and I went up to the depot. She didn't know I was there, and made application for to stay longer, and it was denied. The next morning, there was a sergeant came to the door with a belt and sidearms on to escort me back to the train. And unbeknownst to me, I was key party. See, in each battalion have key people who they send off to do a job in advance of the other rest of the battalion. So I was key party in as much as I had to go in the advance party and help with getting all the transport over to France. I was very mechanical minded, and so I went back to the battalion, and my company commander Simpson, RBY Simpson, who later commanded the battalion in action.
That's the headquarters company.
Headquarters company, where now? He sent for me, he says, now prior to this, we've been told that we wouldn't have to move out of married quarters. The wives would have to stay where they are. Now, when I left to go up on the 48-hour pass, apparently, they'd all been warned to get out of married quarters. Now, he said, sent for us, he says, some sad news, you've got to get out of married quarters just as quickly as you can move. He says, pack up your home, get it away, send it away where you want, sell it. Get rid of it. You've got to vacate the married quarters because you're on the move tomorrow morning. So it doesn't leave you much time, you know, and you think of your sentimental house and this, that and the other. So he says you can take what men you want, you can take what lorries you want. There's £5. That's all the grant you get from the war office. Well, I'd use my money going up north, didn't I? So I go down to Woking Station to try to get a covered van, railway van, to take my stuff up north. But you see, all these people, officers and NCOs and men who had married quarters, had taken all the available covered wagons in Southern Command, everyone from Aldershot. So many troops there had gone. So they said they'd put them on open covered vans for me, but they couldn't insure it. But they tarpaulin it over and then ensure that we'd land up in England in the correct order, you know, decent order. So I'll just stick on that for a moment, because now we are away to war. Many months later on, I received a letter when I was in Nomain in France, the wife telling me that the furniture, that she'd been advised that the furniture had arrived, and when her and her brothers went up to get it from the station, it had been ransacked, stolen, nearly everything was gone. The boxes were open, even some of the boxes were missing, and would nail them down, screw them down, and put wire hats on them. They'd gone. And even the three-piece suite had been slashed, as if by someone to say, these people are dodging away from the war, getting away from London. And they took the vent out on us, but everything had gone bar the wireless, some cutlery, and that little hassock that's around the corner there. The only three things that we got whole, and a few bits of bedding. All the wedding presents, all the beautiful stuff that was saved for and bought prior to getting married, the gifts that she got, a lot was gone. And there was no compensation for it. What had happened in Newcastle, they'd left the stuff lying in the siding without informing the family, and it lay in there, and thieves had got among it, and that was it. We lost it. So I was very much saddened about this, to think that somebody wouldn't look after our soldiers' goods, because they were obviously soldiers, because it had all my names on the kid boxes, Sergeant McLean, etc.
Now, the wife had recovered, and the baby as well, and they'd come out of hospital and gone back to live with her parents, had
yes.
Is that right?
But sadly, they hadn't recovered.
Oh.
No. More very serious complications set in. The wife recovered, and she came home with a baby, to find that the baby took diphtheria. And diphtheria was a killer then, them days. And the doctor found that her mother was the carrier of the disease. She had it. So the daughter had to get out of bed, and the baby was now in Watergate Hospital. So was her mother. She had to get out of bed and look after the family, her father and her brothers, and go down to hospital through all the snow and sleep. It's a very bad winter that year, in a poor condition, to go down to see the baby in hospital and see her mother. And it took a toll on her, and I was very worried about it. And I was just writing back and forward to her. And the outcome of this is, months later on, they decided to let the British Army be on holiday and on leave to England for a fortnight. And I was one of the first to go on compassionate leave. But irrespective of what she was like or what was going on, you just had to get on with it. Just the same, you were there, you had to get on with it. So it was a sad part of my whole life was that, because there was fear of losing the baby. The wife was in a bad condition. She was suffering colds, having just got out of bed, having been seriously ill with a hot baby, and her mother being ill, and all this was really a disturbing time for me, but it got over. But sadly, say it, the wife often talks about it, because the army, she thought, was so ruthless. As a matter of fact, she hates the army, through the furniture, through our lovely home going for a burden, and through other things regarding married quarters, where it should have been a happy, peaceful life that we had. It turned into she doesn't like the army at all.
Right, now you were collected at the hospital and put into the key party.
Yes.
What exactly were your duties then in this key party, and what preparations were made by you and your group?
Well, I left the 3-inch mortar platoon, and we had our vehicles and what have you, but I was put on with the MT officer, Major Captain Hutton, who eventually became a company commander in France. I'll tell a story about him later on, about the shooting and how he got wounded and all this. Him and I became firm friends, and the MT sergeant, they had all the MT transport of the battalion to shift down to Bristol. And there we were to embark for Destination X. Nobody knew where, but everybody really did know we were going to that place where the Campbelltown blew up.
Saint-Nazaire.
Saint-Nazaire. we were going to St. Nazaire, and our job was to ensure all the transport got down there, any stragglers, collected them, see that they got down to the port for the embarked them, or helped see that all the stuff embarked upon a ship, go over to on a packet steamer we went on a packet steamer over, and we went to St. Nazaire, and we had to wait there for the heavily laden merchant ships coming in with the transport. Some landed in St. Nazaire, which we all got stuck into and worked hard at unloading, helping to unload, and they had stevedores from Liverpool doing the job who had been enforced into the army. They joined the army engineers, and they were very slippery.